The appeal of Shake Google today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. When young Muslims want to know more about ISIS, they turn to the internet. Shake Google, as one woman calls it. She says the people trying to stop radicalization should use it too.
If we began to fight the fight at the same pace and in the same manner as ISIS, we would overtake them. But we have not even gotten into the game.
Plus, two American reporters based in Africa come back to report on Confederate symbols in the South.
Neither of us are white, and these issues are obviously very tinged with race, so sometimes they got very uncomfortable, sometimes they were very awkward.
And this Canadian decides to sell clean air in a can.
Just to see what the uptake would be on it, right? Because everybody always says, who's going to pay for air?
Find out who is today on The World. Glad you could be with us. Ever since the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino, a lot of questions have been asked. Here's one of the more puzzling ones. How do you keep young Muslims in the West from becoming radicalized? That's where we're going to kick things off today, and we're going to hear two different answers to that question. Let's begin in France. It's still on high alert, almost 6 weeks since the explosions and shootings in Paris. As you'll remember, some of the gunmen were French citizens who'd gotten radicalized. So there's concern that there are more of them or that others might follow their example. But here's the story of one woman born in Morocco, and she's providing a positive role model for young people in France's immigrant suburbs. Marine Olivezi has a story from the city of Dreux.
Bonjour, toutes et à tous.
Latifa Ibn Ziaten introduces herself to middle and high schoolers with a single line.
Alors, je me présente. Je suis la maman d'Imad.
I'm Imad's mom. The couple of hundred teenagers in front of her might not have heard that name before, but they all know the name of the guy who killed him, and Latifa doesn't shy away from it. In March 2012, Mohamed Merah, a Frenchman of Algerian descent, killed seven people in a series of shootings, including three children at a Jewish school. Merah's killing spree and the manhunt that followed marked the beginning of a bad streak. French-born, radicalized young men going to war against their own country. Merah's first victim was a 30-year-old off-duty paratrooper, Latifa's son. She's been crisscrossing the country ever since, touring schools and prisons. She always tells her story standing up, a tribute to her son who refused to lie down before Merah shot him. And she tells it from the day she arrived in France.
I came from Morocco when I was 17. France took me in. My neighbors helped me out. They taught me how to speak and write the language. Then my husband and I started a family. We had five kids. That was my dream, but also a responsibility. I worked the whole time to pay for my kids' clothes, private lessons, vacations. They grew up with a lot of dignity, respect, and love. They were my pride. Mohamed Merah robbed me of that success.
Latifa says life was tough, but it was easier back then to integrate. The neighbors she talks about were French. Now most immigrants live in ghettos, isolated, which gives them little chance to learn the codes of their new country. And their children often grew up feeling like second-class citizens. But Latifa says it's not just society that fails kids like Mohamed Merah. His dad failed him when he abandoned the family. His mom, too. She remarried and placed him up in foster care. Latifa sums up what came next in his life. Dropped out of school, turned petty criminal, landed in jail, where he met radical Muslims and, as Latifa says, turned into a monster. And after the shootings, kids in the suburbs made him the poster child of a lost generation.
I had to see where Merah grew up, so I went to his town, and I saw a group of young people hanging out on the street. I asked, "Do you know where Merah lives?" One of them smiled and said, "Mohamed Merah is a martyr. He's a hero of Islam. He brought France to his knees." When I heard that, it was like my son was killed a second time. I looked at them and said, "Do you know who you're talking to? I'm Imad's mom. Merah's no martyr. He's no hero. He's an assassin."
Latifa says the guys were stunned and ashamed. They stood up, circled around her, and kept saying sorry. That's when she realized she had to get the other side of the story out, hers, and that of the wide majority of immigrants and French-born Muslims who make it, live in peace and serve their country, like her own son did. That's the future she wants for the teenagers in the audience, a lot of them first-generation French. She talks about school, religion, family, and manages to get through to them. At the end, teenage boys come to hug her. A girl bursts into tears. I ask why. She says Latifa reminds her of her own mother. It's the second time this year Latifa pays them a visit. The school district is the most impoverished in the region, with up to 70% of students on public aid. The principal says the first time she came, Latifa was a bit like a firefighter called to the rescue.
Il y a eu un certain nombre de tensions, de crispations au moment des attentats de Charlie Hebdo au sein du collège.
There was some tension here after the Charlie Hebdo attack, Fabien Mertens says. About 50 students refused to do the minute of silence the day after. Some lashed out and said things we couldn't tolerate. Her visit helped us bridge the gap and rebuild a dialogue. The school has come a long way since then, he says. Kids are at peace with who they are, diverse yet unabashedly French. Before leaving, Latifa asks whether they can sing the national anthem. Every single teenager picks up her tune, a bit off key, but without a fuss. For the world, Marine Olivesi, Dreux, France.
We're going to hear now from another woman who works to turn young Muslims away from extremism. Farah Pandith is a senior fellow with Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and the U.S. State Department's former special representative to Muslim communities. She's traveled to dozens of countries to speak directly to young Muslims.
So, Marco, let's remember that we're talking about a billion Muslims around the world under the age of 30 who have seen since 9/11 the word Islam or Muslim on the front pages of papers online and offline. Digital natives who are connected digitally with a swish of their finger online. Ideas that they hear in one part of the world and they think about and see in one part of the world ricochet around the world. So this generation has been drawn to ask questions that their parents' generation and their grandparents' generation may have asked about what it means to be modern and Muslim or what the difference is between culture and religion. But they haven't had instantaneous answers in the same way. Shake Google is the answer that is provided for them. And the loudest voices, the most easily available voices, are those of the extremists. And so you see a very different dimension to this issue of young people, these millennial Muslims around the world facing a crisis of identity in a modern era.
Did you call Google Shake Google?
I did. I called it Shake Google.
Is that your line, or are there kids who say that?
Well, I'll tell you, it was sort of said tongue-in-cheek when I was at the Department of State as I began to keep hearing from kid after kid that where they go for answers are not the traditional places that you would have expected. They're going to where any young person around the world goes to, and that's the internet. They seek answers in the spaces that young people go to. Their influencers are their peer group. So I have seen this happen all over the world. And when I say shake Google, it's because from Google and other social platforms, let's be really clear, it's not just Google, it's all kinds of social platforms out there, whether it's Tumblr, whether it is Twitter, whether it is Facebook or YouTube. You're hearing a conversation among Muslim millennials that is very profound and very important for us to understand, because the peer-to-peer conversation about what they need to do as they navigate their identity comes from their peers in a social and a digital format.
So tell us how a group like ISIS takes advantage of this kind of presence of these young people on the internet. Give us some examples.
Well, it is very clear that you cannot have armies if you do not have recruits. And in order to recruit a young person to come join their so-called caliphate, they need to make it very user-friendly. They need to make it easy for a young person to navigate the social and digital space. They need to have imagery and a narrative that speaks to a millennial generation in a capacity and in a context that makes sense for these young people, just the way an advertiser is advertising to a 16-year-old in a way that makes sense for them. In fact, if you look back at sort of some of the old techniques of how people have lured in others to join gangs or join extremist groups, they've used one-on-one interventions. And that's exactly what ISIS and others are doing. They have the time, they have the capacity, they have the context of young people recruiting young people in language, in culturally appropriate jargon with imagery that makes sense for that millennial generation. And that's really important because that's how you pull people in.
How do you fight that? How do you counter it? I mean, as the ad people will tell you, you don't say, don't buy that deodorant, buy this deodorant.
But you have to remember that when we talk about ISIS as being skilled, their tools are no different from the tools that we have. They are using the exact same platforms and the exact same techniques that we have available to us. So how do you counter it? First, you do the same types of things, but you're using influencers that are pushing back on their analysis and the way in which they're looking at things by peer-friendly, credible, organic voices that make sense for the communities of young people that are being sympathetic or being persuaded or being lured in that direction. And you do it in a medium that makes sense, but you do it at scale, Marco. That's the difference. You can't just have one one-off campaign somewhere in the world and say, we tried to do this. We, as non-ISIS, have yet to try to do this in a way that is competitive, that is as vibrant and as determined as ISIS is. If we began to fight the fight at the same pace and in the same manner as ISIS, we would overtake them. But we have not even gotten into the game.
Have you seen models of your approach at work?
We have seen in the last few years more Americans looking at this issue of radicalization than ever before. I think you've seen a change in the game, and I think it's based on many things. But Americans themselves are asking questions that you're asking, Marco. How can we do this better, and how can we protect our youth? So in very small pockets, you've seen community groups, interfaith groups, as well as Muslim groups begin to think about how to educate parents so they understand that their kids could be at risk because those are the groups from which ISIS, you know, recruits. You also have seen more education programs learning about what ISIS is doing in others. But you haven't seen things at scale in the way they need to happen here in the United States to really make people understand that there's more that they can be doing to protect their young kids from this online recruitment.
Farah Pandith is a senior fellow with Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Great to speak with you. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
Continuing today to share some of our top music picks from 2015, artists and albums and songs that really hit us in a great way. We'll be dropping tracks into the show from now until the end of the year. Here's a song that was originally composed by Lennon and McCartney. It was reworked in Spanish this year by one of my favorite bands in the business, the Latin Jammers from Austin, Texas, Grupo Fantasma. This is Por Qué from their CD Problemas.
Bien, porque el mundo es redondo.
Grupo Fantasma there with Porque. More music faves later on the show and 24/7 at PRI.org. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. You may know that a couple of years ago, Amazon's Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, and it sparked concerns about the newspaper's editorial integrity. Similar thing happening in China today. Chinese internet giant Alibaba, owned by tycoon Jack Ma, announced it's buying the South China Morning Post. Jonathan Kamen is in Beijing for the Los Angeles Times, and he says this is big, given how journalism works in China.
When you're reading coverage of China as an American, you need to know that there are only a couple of hundred American correspondents here producing all of that news. So you have the most populous country in the world, 1.3 billion people, and as many people covering it as would cover a small city in the States. So the Chinese government censors its own media and doesn't let Chinese journalists write for the Western press. So this is where the South China Morning Post comes in. For a long time, it was considered one of the best, if not the absolute best, English language newspaper in Asia. And it's located in Hong Kong, which is near China, but free of Beijing censorship.
Yeah, I mean, and so that's kind of key, because the media in Hong Kong is vastly different from what you get with media on mainland China.
Absolutely. So every year when June 4th rolls around, the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, the Chinese press is just a blanket nothing. Discussion of Tiananmen is banned. And yet the South China Morning Post runs these beautiful graphics and these great articles with interviews with former protesters and their relatives. And it's just a wonderful package of coverage. Now, people are worried that after Ma buys the South China Morning Post, this is a rare and valuable resource, and Alibaba will essentially crush it. So after Alibaba bought the paper, Zhou Cai, who's the company's executive VP, he said he hoped that the newspaper would offset Western bias in the English language press. Shorthand for, there's too much China bashing out there, and we want to overcome that.
I mean, is that kind of a preemptive defense? Because, I mean, owning a newspaper that represents a free press puts Jack Ma in direct conflict with the Chinese government, it would seem, unless you've got somebody in the company like Vice Chairman Zhou Cai saying, let's kind of offset the bias.
Yeah, but the thing is, Zhou Cai also said that he would give the paper full editorial independence. So we've sort of crossed the Rubicon here. We've never had a paper of this size in Hong Kong or abroad purchased by a Chinese, mainland Chinese entity.
Why do you think Jack Ma wanted this paper? Why did he buy it?
Jack Ma is an interesting case. So aside from being the richest man in China, he also represents something special to both the party, the Communist Party, and the West. His life story feels distinctly American. He's a former English teacher in the city Hangzhou, very poor. He worked hard. He made tough decisions. He made a fortune. He speaks English. He has this guru-like aura, and he goes to talks, and he talks on TV shows around the world. To the West, he's relatable, and to the Chinese government, he's a friendly face and also a reliable ally. So I think Ma may have felt that he was in a unique position to bring a more positive view of China to the West, and nobody else in China now occupies that position.
I mean, I want to ask you, is he a secret emissary for Beijing? Is there anything to support that?
That's where things get really tricky. No, and when you really delve into the financial aspect of it, it's really difficult to tell with any of these guys just how closely affiliated they are with Beijing. And yet, in China, the party is obsessed with control in all levels of society, and it seems almost unthinkable that they would let a man in a corporation get this big without having a high degree of control over his operations.
Hasn't Jack Ma said that he's interested in making China, the People's Republic, look better? And could this purchase of this paper be one way of achieving that?
Absolutely. Well, Ma's famous for saying something along the lines of, you should love the government but not marry it. You know, he's always been sort of a bit of a renegade in that sense. So I think what people are worried about in this case is that he's gone ahead and married the government.
Jonathan Kamen, the Asia correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, speaking with me from Beijing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, as Jonathan and anyone else living in Beijing know all too well, the Chinese capital has a smog problem, to put it mildly. Residents there and in several other Chinese cities often wear face masks to try to protect themselves. Those who can afford it get special air filters for their apartments and don't leave on red alert days. And now for those who really yearn for clean air, a new pricier option, clean bottled air from Canada at about $23 a bottle. Seriously. Troy Paquette is co-founder of Vitality Air, which bottles air in Canada to sell overseas.
So all of our air is collected from the beautiful parks of Banff National Park. We go down to Banff and we just sit down there and we capture the air and we bring it back to Edmonton where we compress it and bottle it.
So you capture the air, you like take a bottle and kind of like pass it through the air and then cap it?
No, we have a different process than that, but a bit of a trade secret there, so I can't really share that one with you, Marco.
Trade secret, I mean, it would be as simple as just putting a bottle on a table and then putting a cap on it, right?
We could do that, but the problem is that's what the other people have been doing, and all that ends up happening is when you crack the cap open, you get a couple whiffs of breath of fresh air, and for us, we actually compress it. So then our cans contain about 150 intonations worth of air, so...
Okay, so I gather this started as a novelty, almost a joke for you, selling a Ziploc bag of air online to see if people would actually pay for it.
Yeah, so originally my background is I'm a real estate broker and Moses is a mortgage broker. Moses Lamb, the other co-founder. And basically, we came up with this idea of trying to sell fresh air in a baggie just to see what the uptake would be on it, right? Because everybody always says, who's going to pay for air? And from there, it just kind of snowballed and away it went. And at first, it was somewhat of a novelty product. But at the end of the day, what we're finding now is with the smog so bad in Beijing, people are using it and they're saying it helps them.
Okay, so let's say you gobble down a can of this in a day. That's 150 breaths. Is there any health benefit, scientific health benefit, to having, say, 150 breaths of clean air from Banff a day?
We're steering away from health claims because we can't make health claims. It's not a medical device. But the way I've been telling people is if you're standing next to an exhaust pipe of a car versus standing in the Rocky Mountains, there's your health benefit right there,
right.
Just having clean air.
You guys making a profit?
Not yet. Unfortunately, there's been a very high overhead. Our product's very unique in that everything is hand bottled. So it's Moses and I that collect the air. It's Moses and I that fill the cans. Right now, it's just the two of us, and we're just not quite there yet.
Let me just ask you this, though, because you capture this air, you compress it, you bottle it, and then ship it across the world. That's a lot of resources. Do you ever worry you're adding to the problem of pollution that's ruining China's air in the first place? I mean, it's kind of like you guys are the Fiji water of bottled air.
We're getting a lot of those questions and comments. We're using as much recycled product as we can as far as papers and cardboards. Everything that we use is recyclable. One of the things that we're still figuring out is how to start like a deposit program. Our cans are aluminum and metal, and they can be recycled pretty easily. We're doing the best we can there. Again, at the end of the day, it's up to the end users to recycle.
Troy Paquette, co-founder of Vitality Air. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Deep cleansing breath. News headlines are coming right up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A family from India moves to America.
My father, who moved from India to the U.S. and eventually settled in West Virginia, when he got there, he bought a Confederate flag, a vanity plate for his car. He had no idea what it meant.
A reporter's quest to understand Confederate symbols. That's ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. When it comes to covering stories in the U.S. on the show, we often try to get some perspective from the outside, like race in America, especially this year. Ferguson, Baltimore, Charleston, and the seemingly never-ending headlines that remind us of the racial tension in this country, whether it's the tragedy of Sandra Bland or the confusing identity of Rachel Dolezal. This has been a year like no other in recent memory. Two American reporters based in Kenya also felt it. Mike Onyego and Rupa Guganeni. Call this an insider-outsider view of things. Mike and Rupa report throughout Africa. Mike's African-American from Chicago. Rupa is Indian-American from West Virginia. And this summer, they went to New Orleans to take a look at the controversy over Confederate symbols in the wake of the South Carolina church shooting. They reported for the podcast Us and Them. Rupa and Mike join me from the BBC studios in Nairobi, where I was just a week ago. Hi, Rupa. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, Marco.
Thanks for joining us. This podcast, I got to say, was a really compelling way into this issue. Just tell us what your approach was. Was it to come at it as American foreign correspondents or almost as foreigners?
Well, yeah, that was kind of the idea when we were sort of talking about the issue of Confederate history and Confederate identity in Kenya. We cover a lot of civil wars out here, you know, primarily in Sudan and Somalia. Having covered them for so long, we just kind of we saw what was going on in the South and in New Orleans and the sort of history around these things and the fight around the narratives of who won, who lost, who was right, who was wrong. And we saw a lot of echoes in the things that we cover in Africa. And so we just thought, you know, let's keep our foreign correspondents' hats on and try to go down there and see if we can maybe see something different about it. Because obviously, as Americans, these debates are very rigid, but you know, maybe an outside perspective might lend some new insights.
So you come over kind of wearing your foreign correspondent's hat. How do the people you talk to in New Orleans, how did they treat you?
Well, yeah, that's a complicated answer. I mean, they were on the face very nice. You know, we didn't really have too much problem chatting with people, talking with people. But, you know, it's complicated because we're both neither of us are white, and these issues are obviously very tinged with race. So sometimes they got very uncomfortable. Sometimes they were very awkward. Sometimes we kind of wanted to chip in simply because there were just things from our perspective as Americans that live abroad, also as Americans of color, that we just kind of seemed off or funny or sort of awkward or bizarre to us.
I also think that people saw us and sort of knew where we stood or thought they knew where we stood, and therefore they sort of wanted to convince us of their goodness or their rightness. And as journalists, we tried very hard sort of not make up our minds before we talked to people. So that was always an interesting the conversations we had where everybody, there was a lot of posturing, I think, on both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was a little surprised by just kind of how comfortable people, mostly white people, seem to be talking to you as people of color about some pretty inflammatory things. Let's listen to one example.
I don't see very many blacks being oppressed around here or in anywhere else in the South. In fact, if anything, I see white people going out of their way to help people who are not looking like them.
All right. That guy doesn't even sound like he's from the South. You even had people suggest to you that slavery wasn't that bad. How did they justify that? And what was your reaction when you heard things like that?
Well, that soundbite, that's from Jason, a man that we met at a rally around Lee Circle. And he
and what was that rally
he works
about?
As a, it was a rally that was hosted by the Sons of Confederate Veterans. And it was in support of the Robert E. Lee Monument. He was very quick to introduce himself as an amateur historical preservationist, but also somebody who was not affiliated with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. And he, as you noted, doesn't really sound very Southern. He's not even, actually, I don't think he was born in the South.
In Kansas, I think.
He was born in Kansas. I sort of pegged him as a moderate in the debate. And then we met him later on, and then he sort of launched into this 3-4 hour conversation with us, and it turns out that he held what I felt were some pretty extreme views.
Inflammatory.
Yeah.
With this debate, with the Confederate monuments and the sort of history of the Confederacy, you know, slavery was kind of this awkward heart of the issue. Everyone knew they would have to address it at some point, and so some people tried to say, okay, you know, the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery, but a lot of people maybe acknowledged that they couldn't get around it. And so then we're trying to soften the blow of slavery when it came to these debates and discussions. And that's kind of where you got into all these arguments about, you know, maybe the economics of slavery or things like, well, you know, if that's your property, you don't intentionally damage your property. So why would they treat them badly? Or we heard at the rally, essentially arguments like you would have starved to death in Africa or you would have died of disease in Africa, so you're lucky you're over here.
You should be thankful.
You should be thankful that you made it over here.
I'm still kind of fascinated by how these people kind of perceived you, like what they thought you were. I mean, you guys were taking pulse as reporters, not covering breaking news, where you might have had, you know, press credentials around your neck. Did they see you as journalists?
Yeah, I would say they did.
Yeah.
But you know, we weren't on any kind of deadline, right? So we weren't trying to just get the sort of the big inflammatory statement out of either side. We were just kind of sitting back and listening.
Right. We spent a lot of time with these people, and I think that they appreciated that. And we didn't, for the most part, we listened.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it comes across in the podcast that you are kind of flabbergasted, but you do take it all in stride, employing as much, you know, journalistic objectivity as possible. But then, and this was kind of incredible, you meet a guy from Mozambique in a local bar in New Orleans. His name is Marcelino, and you're talking to him about the American Civil War. And then, Rupa, you bring up the issue of his country's civil war. Let's listen to that.
So Mozambique had a very long civil war, and it's over now. How do people remember it?
We don't talk about that war no more. We don't, because we know like was a lot of pain involved, a lot of people die. If we talk, will bring us more sadness, and nobody want to talk about it. And I believe most of the black people here, they're part of the problem, because all they do just complain. It's like, okay, it was done. It wasn't fair. But what you going to do? You going to go back to the past and change?
Wow, that is so complex, hearing that Mozambican man. And then you're there with the American named Jason. He's listening in. And he's actually thrilled to hear this African immigrant say that American blacks basically need to get over it.
Yeah, that was a really kind of hard thing to see happen, because I think having that guy come in the way he did, it almost shut the conversation down.
I mean, it undermined everything we were saying.
Yeah, whatever kind of debate we were having, whatever sort of degree to which he was willing to maybe concede another side, another perspective, just sort of ended at that moment.
Then Mike, you and Rupa, you go off and you sit down in your car and you start talking, and Rupa secretly records the conversation. And Mike, you are pissed off. Let's hear this.
That guy, he knows what colonialism looks like. He knows that. And he can't see it here? Are you kidding me? Black people are all good because it's America? Are you kidding me? My dad never thought that ever. I can't believe it. How dare you tell me that? I don't know what I'm talking about.
So, Mike, as you say, that guy knows what colonialism looks like, the Mozambican man. Why was this man, Marcelino, the one who really made you lose it, do you think?
Because, like I said, it undermines any cogent argument that you can make for a closer look at American history, right? The argument is always there that African Americans should just move past slavery and move on, but there isn't often a chance where you get to debate the sort of long-term effects that's had on a massive population, right? So for someone from Africa to be just given such instant credibility to just allow people to move past some really unresolved issues, it wasn't fair. I mean, it just swept so much under the rug so quickly that it was almost shocking to me. You know, it was like traumatic to just kind of have that conversation end so abruptly.
Rupa, for you, what did this trip actually mean? I mean, is it about just how hard it is for outsiders to grasp the weight of symbols?
Yeah. So I'm from West Virginia, and there's a lot of Confederate flags around West Virginia. So I sort of grew up with that symbol around. And even my father, who's an immigrant and who moved from India to the U.S. and eventually settled in West Virginia, when he got there, he bought a Confederate flag, a vanity plate for his car.
Wow.
He had no idea what it meant. He thought it looked really nice, and he thought it was some take on the British flag. And then eventually a friend of his said, hey, why are you a brown man driving with this Confederate flag on your car? And then connected the dots for him. So that's sort of an example to me of how complicated these histories and these symbols are for outsiders, and then by extension sort of how complicated and confusing race in America is to outsiders, which I think Marcelino is experiencing.
I mean, all this I find really fascinating because I was born in New York but grew up from the age of six in North Carolina in the mid-60s. And, you know, the road from the two brainy college towns, Chapel Hill to Durham, 15501, was called the Jefferson Davis Highway. And, you know, I saw Confederate flags everywhere as a kid, but these things weren't discussed. It was just kind of part of the landscape. And I guess at the time I just thought, well, maybe the Civil War never really ended and all of this was proof of that. But your generation is fighting back, and as this podcast shows, you're digging in and trying to kind of get a grasp on this. What do you think has happened in the course of 20 or 30 years?
I think there was a moment where maybe it was the 80s or the 90s or whatever, where we kind of started to tell ourselves that we had solved these issues, that they were finished. And if anything, the sort of last couple of years have showed us that these issues haven't been fully resolved, these issues of race, these issues of class, these issues of whatever you want to call it, white supremacy, of which the Confederacy is a sort of a symbol to some people. So with everything coming back out, people are starting to say, no, let's have the whole discussion, because we didn't get to maybe address the whole issue. There were sort of piecemeal adjustments, but a lot of people still feel like that they haven't been able to sort of give the full story. And that's kind of what this is about, right? You know, I mean, what the supporters of the flag talk about this slogan, history, not hate. What that does is sort of take one side of these symbols, you know, because yes, these guys were generals. They were gallant military leaders, but it kind of ignores half of what they were fighting for. You know, it takes their actions without the intent, you know. And I'm not saying that there is one answer to it, but like to not address slavery, to not address what the Confederacy was fighting for, is a sort of an obfuscation, because it's ignoring half of the issue.
I mean, just last week, the city council in New Orleans voted to take down four Confederate symbols. What do you make of that? And do you think it shows the discussion of the legacy of slavery is being had and is progressing?
It's definitely the conversation and debate is definitely happening, and it feels very messy. I mean, we were at some of those hearings and there was a lot of screaming and not very much listening. But to me, it feels like progress because they're in the same room. People are being honest. They might not be very nice to each other, but people are saying how they feel. And to me, that feels like progress.
Yeah, having those two opinions out in the open together, it really is different, because previously the sort of these two sides of New Orleans may not have ever even met each other, you know, and they weren't interacting really, not truly. So if anything, the city council's decision is forcing the issue, and maybe they won't fully resolve it, but at least it's like they're talking now.
Journalists Mike Onyego and Rupa Guganeni, they reported their story, A Confederate Reckoning, for the podcast Us and Them. And they spoke with me from Nairobi, where they're both based. Us and Them is a podcast about the fault lines that separate Americans. Now, one thing that I know brings Americans together is music. And that's my cue to serve up another of the albums that really impressed us this year. This one only came out last month, and I haven't had a chance to tell you about it yet. The album is titled Junoon, and it's a great example of music bridging all sorts of fault lines. It's the brainchild of Israeli composer and performer Shai Bensur. He splits his time between Israel and India, and has long been enthralled by Qawwali, the devotional music popular with Muslim Sufis. So he created a series of compositions that are part Qawwali, part Hebrew, part Arabic, but the music soars in a totally organic way. The Indian Qawwali Ensemble, the Rajasthan Express, was involved. Also, the guitarist for the British band Radiohead, Johnny Greenwood, heard what Bensur had done, and he got involved in the project. Everyone got together to record the album inside a 15th century fort in Jodhpur in India. Here's some more from Junoon, which, by the way, means passion or even mania in Hindi.
Bye.
Music from the new CD, Janoon. You can check out more of our favorite albums of 2015 at PRI.org. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman with the world. The War on Christmas, Puritan edition. That's just ahead. But first, I want to update you on a story out of India that we first covered back in 2012. I don't want to upset you with the details. Again, you surely remember that fatal gang rape of a university student in New Delhi. Just a few days ago, one of her assailants was released. He was a teenager at the time of the attack and only had to serve 3 years for his role in what happened. His release sparked protests. The government has responded by implementing tougher penalties for juveniles accused of, quote, heinous crimes. Reporter Ritu Chatterjee has been following the story, and I asked her why this case and this young man's release are still so flammable.
Marco, you have to remember that this case is one that sparked just public outrage that we hadn't seen in India. Just ordinary people, not just activists, people unrelated to the victims, stepped out onto the streets of New Delhi, other parts of India, protesting widespread sexual violence in the country and demanding the government to make legal changes to make the country safer for women.
So 3 years after this horrible crime was committed, a lot of sexual crimes continue. Will lowering the age to 16 really be that inhibiting? I mean, how's this law going to play out on the ground with young men?
There's the big worry, Marco, because what people opposed to the law point out is that children commit only 1.2% of all crimes, and most rapes that are reported committed by juveniles are filed by parents of teenagers who are engaged in consensual relationship. So the worry is that this is not going to hinder or prevent future cases of sexual violence or violence against women from happening, but also that the law is going to be misused by parents of teenagers who are in a relationship. So I'm not sure this is actually going to change things at all on the ground. In fact, as a lot of people point out, this is kind of a feel-good measure where you've placated people who were protesting, but actually does nothing to make India safer for women.
Ritu, just take your mind back to 2012. You learned that there was this juvenile as part of this group of rapists. How did you feel about him then?
You know, Marco, obviously the brutality again, which everybody keeps going back to, and I can't help going back to that. I remember just horrified, wondering just how a juvenile could be so brutal. But then again, you know, as a science reporter, I have to put on that hat and then think, well, you know, if there's anything neuroscience tells us is that juveniles are not, you know, are easily swayed by peer pressure. They're not very good at impulse control. And that sort of scientific evidence, and I think should be taken into creating laws. So my personal reaction is obviously one of being horrified, but on the other hand, you know, my own emotional reaction, anyone's emotional reaction about one particular perpetrator, one particular case, cannot be the basis for creating laws for an entire country.
Finally, Ritu, what about the other perpetrators of the crime? Still in jail? What's their status?
They're still in jail. Well, one person, the leader of the group, committed suicide a couple years ago, but the other three are still in prison. You know, they got death sentences, but they appealed to the Supreme Court, but there haven't been any hearings. So their death sentences have been stayed till the court actually hears the case out and decides on them. So they remain behind bars.
Ritu Chatterjee, thank you very much for bringing us up to date.
Thank you, Marco.
Finally today, this is the time of year when it's pretty common to hear someone complaining about the so-called war on Christmas. Whoever designs the cups at Starbucks knows what I'm talking about. But America's relationship with the Christian holiday is pretty complex. Like, I had no idea until today that Christmas used to be illegal in Massachusetts and much of New England and remained taboo here until at least 1870 when the feds declared it a national holiday. Hard to believe in 2015, but the world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolf, says it is true. What's this about, Chris? Because Massachusetts, as we know, was founded by English folks seeking to practice their form of Christianity in their own way. So how come they didn't like Christmas?
Well, Marco, they're called Puritans because they wanted to purify the church of all its old pagan and pre-Christian customs and legacies. You know, the things that are kind of rooted in Germanic and Celtic folklore. They were just anathema to the Puritans. So, you know, decking your halls with boughs of holly and ivy, or making fires and lighting candles, or hanging gaudy decorations, or carousing and singing to keep the old year alive, kissing under the mistletoe. Puritans thought it was all extremely unchristian and fought pretty hard to stamp this nonsense out in their new city upon a hill, the new Jerusalem they were building in America. Even feasting was not approved. They, instead of calling it Yuletide, they'd call it Fool's Tide.
So Puritans, but they're Christians, so what did they do on December 25th, the alleged day of Jesus' birth?
Nothing. Unless it fell on the Sabbath, it was treated like an entirely normal working day. Everyone was expected to work like it was just any other day, or go to school, or whatever it was that you were doing. I mean, their argument is simply that there's nothing in Scripture to warrant the celebration of Christ's birth. They denounced it as like kind of, Christmas is kind of a sly trick invented by the early Catholic Church to kind of graft Christian ideas onto the old kind of pagan ways of Europe that celebrated the birth of the new year with the solstice and what have you. And so the Puritans saw it as superstitious at best, or possibly heretical. So ministers for a time could be arrested for even holding a Christmas service, ministers of religion. You know, and anyone caught celebrating Christmas for about a generation in the 1600s would be subject to a fine of 5 shillings, which is about a week's wages.
So if I were to go out caroling at the time, would Puritans arrest me?
Yeah, I mean, Christmas was actually like tolerated from 1681. But after that, anyone caught making merry or just being, you know, doing anything like a Christmas revel would be arrested and fined for disturbing the peace way into the 18th century. And it slowly became a little bit more tolerant, but still cultural taboo well into the late 1800s.
Christmas, as I said, was made a federal holiday in 1870. But like in 1869, were the Puritans still like, we're going to arrest people if you celebrate Christmas?
Yep. They would literally go around making sure that schools were open and that people were working, and really not happy about it. I think some social historians are suggesting that the poor servants who came to New England for work rather than for their faith kept the old traditions alive. And then in the 19th century, the population of Massachusetts is transformed with mass immigration, you know, especially from Ireland. And so, you know, everything suddenly becomes more popular. And then Ulysses S. Grant, that was president in 1870, thought it would be a great idea to unify the country by imposing Christmas on New England.
Well, can you imagine if that happened today? We are going to impose Christmas today, whether you like it or not. Well, that is what's happening, isn't it?
I couldn't possibly comment.
The World's Chris Wolfe, thank you, as always.
You're welcome, Marco. And I can say it now, Merry Christmas.
All right, all right. Christmas is still 2 days away. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. See you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.